Hi there, have you got something else lined up to listen to next? After you finish this, why not find a pile of books with me, Kate Evans, on Books Plus? It's all there, ready for you on the RN website.
He was one of the leading authorities on the origin of Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Gesiver Mesh died recently in England, aged 88. He had an enormous impact on both scholars and the public. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to The Spirit of Things on RN. I knew Gesiver Mesh both as a graduate student reading his work and later interviewing him for a two-part Compass program on the Dead Sea Scrolls, the most significant biblical discovery of the 20th century. The occasion was the first and only visit of the Scrolls to these shores in the year 2000. I'd already met the dapper gentleman a couple of years before in his Oxford cottage that backed onto some woods where wild deer nibbled at the edges of his wife's flower garden. This time I was there to talk about his autobiography called Providential Accidents. In today's program, you'll hear a few excerpts from that interview in 1998. You'll also hear from Amy Jill Levine, professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt University in the U.S., and Martin Goodman, a former student and colleague of Gesiver Mesh at Wolfson College, Oxford. Vermeesch was the first to translate the complete Dead Sea Scrolls into English, his eighth language, in 1962. Later, he would become one of the most significant Jesus scholars, showing the messianic figure to be first and foremost a Jewish holy man.
Scholars and quite a number of people just in churches recognized that Jesus was a Jew. But until Gesiver Mesh, the idea of Jesus' Judaism was seen as more as a corrective. Jesus came to fix Judaism. He stood over against it. For some, he was the only Jew who cared about women, who cared about social justice. He was the only voice at the time that was true to the prophets of Israel and truly interpreted Torah. So before Gesiver Mesh, Jesus was seen as a Jew, but over against a fallen, misogynist, ossified Judaism. And what Vermeesch did is said, no, Jesus should be looked at as completely within Judaism, making sense within a vibrant, lively, rich, and dedicated Jewish culture.
Gesiver Mesh was born to Hungarian Jewish parents, but both converted to Catholicism in 1931. Their conversion didn't save them from the Nazis, 13 years on, and Geza, alone and studying for the priesthood, went into hiding. Where did you spend the war?
In Hungary, running from east to west and then from west towards Budapest. That was in 1944. I started off in northeastern Hungary. I spent some time in Budapest hiding, moved on practically to the Austrian frontier, to the west, in the late autumn of 1944, at which moment things became even worse because the extreme Nazi party of the Arrow Cross took over the government in October 1944, at which stage I said, now I must go somewhere where I can really get lost in a larger crowd. And with the help of the priest who actually baptized the family in 1931, who by that time became a bishop, with his help, I got to Budapest and tried to get myself lost among 200 or 300 students in the Central Theological College attached to the university. This bishop was extremely kind and helpful. A few months later, lost his life when, again, as a loving and courageous man, I was trying to protect a group of women from Russian soldiers, and they simply shot him dead. In fact, he was beatified by the Pope, the Blessed William Upper.
Giza, you were to enter a very unusual Roman Catholic order called the Fathers of Our Lady of Zion.
Well, the reason for entering this congregation, I was that first of all, I was very unhappy in a general priestly setting. And secondly, although I tried to enter the Dominican order, I was simply not accepted. And the reason, the untold reason, was that they didn't want anybody with Jewish background. And then I, in a kind of accidental way, I heard about the Fathers of Zion. And I imagined wrongly that all the members were Jewish converts. And when I was still in my provincial college, I screwed up enough courage to write a letter in French asking for admission. I sent this letter, and there was no answer. Until the very day of my departure, on that morning, the letter arrived from France saying, yes, they were interested in me and I wanted more information. If that letter had stayed in the post for one more day, probably it would have never reached me. Well, anyhow, cutting the story short, I reached the Theological College of the Fathers of Sion, which was in Belgium, in Louvain, and I carried on with my studies, concentrating especially on the study of Hebrew and of the Hebrew Bible. Was during that period that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, and I got interested in them. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on them and became, in inverted commas, an expert as a youngster, because my doctoral dissertation, which was published in 1953, was one of the first substantial books on this subject.
Yes, and it's remarkable comparing it to what followed, because in that period the Dead Sea Scrolls were more readily available.
Well, in one way, yes. I mean, in that sense that the big scrolls, which were discovered in 1947, were very promptly published between 1950 and 1955. 455, all of them became public property. So that in the early period, it was much easier to keep abreast, and the people working on them were also much more enthusiastic than they became later on. So that there was an enormous amount of information flowing from the press, appearing in all the journals, all the periodicals, in the newspapers. So that, in fact, it was easy, in a way, to know whatever was knowable at that time. Later, it became much more difficult, but I suppose we will come to that later.
Yes, in fact, let's just keep to that period for the moment. Your own study of the Hebrew Bible, for example, was something of a departure for a Catholic scholar, was it not?
Well, the problem was, in the first half of the present century, that the papal authorities were very unkeen on giving academic freedom to Catholic scholars to study the Bible. The Bible was considered as a somewhat dangerous book, good for Protestants, but not that good for Catholics. And what Catholic scholars were allowed to say were only things which were in full harmony with the official traditional teachings of the Church.
So that, for example, historical critical scholarship, such as Wellhausen started, and that whole tradition would not have been so welcomed?
Certainly not welcome. In fact, at one stage it was really taboo. By the time I became a student, things were beginning to be slightly less constricted.
Geza Vermeersch here on The Spirit of Things, recounting his biblical studies after the war, which wasn't a popular subject for Catholic scholars. As a Jewish convert and priest in the order of Our Fathers of the Lady of Sion, he would soon find himself laying the foundations for a shift in Catholic-Jewish relations.
I was posted to Paris, which was the center of the religious order, and the place where the fairly influential small periodical of the order was published. And the editor of this journal was another Jewish convert, also of Hungarian origin, by the name of Paul Demann. And he was engaged in a kind of one-man campaign, aided and abetted by an extremely capable young woman by the name of René Bloch. The two of them started off a work first by dealing with the theological presuppositions of Christian anti-Judaism, and also leading a campaign against the distortion in Catholic education of all things relating to the Jews. Quite frankly, when one reads today the articles and the little booklet that they published, one hardly can believe that this was possible. The level of anti-Semitism propagated in Catholic educational books at every level of education, from primary school to theological colleges. And really, this is where we had our efforts concentrated, trying to put the record straight, to convert the Catholic Church to the truth.
Well, in fact, didn't that catalyze something of a shift for the order itself in terms of its own calling, its own mission?
Oh, certainly. The order started off originally with the aim of converting the Jews to Catholicism. But in a way, as a result of our effort, which about 10 years later became official church doctrine, defined in the statements relating to the Jews in the Second Vatican Council, the whole Catholic attitude and consequently also the inspiration of the religious order, fathers and sisters, changed from conversion to collaboration, to mutual understanding, to amitié judéo-chrétienne, to friendship between Christians and Jews. And this is how it continues. The only curious consequence of these things was that by that time, none of the three persons, Paul Demann, René Bloch, and myself, were any longer part of the movement. René Bloch died, and Demann and myself, by that time, left the Sion Order and the Catholic Church.
Now, could it be said that instead of converting the Jews to Catholicism, in a way, your work focusing on Jesus was sort of converting the church to a more Jewish view of their own tradition?
The straight answer is yes. Because if one accepts the idea that we can know something about the historical Jesus, which for about 50 years in the first half of this century was considered as academically unsound, if not impossible. But if it is accepted that we can know something about him, one realizes very soon that we are dealing with a totally Jewish person who had totally Jewish ideas, whose religion was totally Jewish, and whose culture, whose aims, whose aspirations could be understood only in the framework of Judaism. So when finally, after many years of study of Jewish history, I took, as it were, a sabbatical to enjoy myself and decided to write a book on Jesus, entitled Jesus the Jew, To my great surprise, it was greeted both by Jews and Christians as something that would put the research on the historical Jesus on an entirely new basis. And whereas for years before there were no books on the historical Jesus, for the last 25 years, Jesus the Jew was published in 1973. One book after the other is being published on the subject, and what sounded at that time something absolutely revolutionary and sensational has become almost a cliché. Everybody talks of Jesus the Jew today.
And yet you did have some detractors at the time. Was there not some concern that this was forcing Jesus back into a tradition that he was meant to be breaking away from?
Naturally, so some conservative people did not welcome this kind of revolutionary, novel approach to Jesus.
Christians, of course, have seen Jesus as spearheading the church. Was Vermeersch then challenging that view?
Vermeersch's major interest was locating Jesus within his own Jewish context, and that meant a recuperation of the view of Judaism that a number of people held. So for those who believed that Judaism had no spirituality and had no charismatic figures, Vermeersch recovered Jewish spirituality. He recovered rabbis from the Talmud, from Midrash, who very much like Jesus had personal, deep spiritual connections with God, who had personal and deep sense of what nature was, and who had a deep concern for their fellow Jews, men and women both.
At the time that Geza Vermeersch started to study the life of Jesus, how many Jews would have been plowing that particular scholarly terrain?
Vermeersch was one of the few, and ironically, a number of the Jews who began looking at Jesus in his Jewish context actually wound up being Jews who, for one reason or another, wound up converting to Roman Catholicism. In some cases, much like Vermeersch's family, in order to be protected from the Nazis or to assimilate within a broader European culture that looked disfavorably upon those people who still held on to their Judaism. So a number of those early scholars were Jews by birth and may well have been Jews by personal inclination, but formally they were Catholics or Protestants.
Of course, Geza Vermeersch became a priest, but then he renounced that vow, got married, and sort of re-entered the Jewish community, but perhaps more on the periphery. How did Jewish scholars and Christian scholars view this man who had had a connection to both Judaism and Christianity, but was somewhere in between?
I can't speak to how scholars viewed him personally, but I can speak to how they viewed his work. When I was an undergraduate, my professor, who was a Lutheran, said, "You must read this. This is extremely important." When I got to graduate school, my professors, Congregationalists, Catholic, Methodist, said, "You must read this." And they particularly came to me and said, "You, Jewish woman, you must read this because I think this is what you'd be interested in." So the respect was enormous, and the respect was there because Vermeersch had earned it. He had done the hard work in working on the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the first. He had done the hard work of plowing through the rabbinic literature, which is sometimes difficult to follow, indeed arcane, and he knew the Christian stuff as well. So no one could possibly question his own academic credibility.
Amy Jill Levine commenting on Jesus scholar, the late Geza Vermeersch. She's the author of Jesus, the Misunderstood Jew, and was recently in Australia speaking to religion educators. This Spirit of Things on RN is devoted to remembering Geza Vermeersch, the first translator into English of the complete Dead Sea Scrolls. How connected was your research into the Dead Sea Scrolls, or indeed at that time? There were some scholars, for example, who argued that maybe Jesus was part of an Essene-like sect, such as the Qumran community. What did you feel about those matters?
I never accepted these views or adopted such an approach. The only possible link is John the Baptist. But even there, I believe that if John was ever a member of the Essene community, by the time we encounter him in the New Testament story, he is certainly an independent person who is no longer an Essene. But I mean, I have no reason to believe that he ever was one.
Now, you actually finally got to see Qumran yourself, and that must have been an extraordinary experience for you.
Well, indeed, that was an amazing event. I felt that before publishing my dissertation as a book, I had to have some direct view of things. And I was sent to Jerusalem, to Israel, where there were some Dead Sea Scrolls, but I was not able to see them. And then I managed to slip across the Mandelbaum Gate from Israeli Jerusalem to Jordanian Jerusalem and spent about a month there at the Dominicans Biblical School, and had an opportunity to visit Qumran and see some of the caves which were known at that time, and see the first archaeological digs, and also see some of the fragments, Dead Sea Scrolls fragments, which were collected by Arabs, clandestine diggers, and brought in matchboxes to the Ecole Biblique to sell them.
The slow translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls, beginning under the Jordanians, is a well-known story, and here Geza comments on the continuation of the saga.
In fact, we know now that by the end of the 1950s, the very large majority of the fragments had been deciphered and translated and identified. But it did not become available to scholars at large. It was just kept for those who were working on the manuscripts. Then along came the Six-Day War in 1967, when practically all the manuscripts came under Israeli control. The Israelis themselves did not interfere with the publishing policy of the small group already working for about 20 years. And as a result, things became even worse. So that during the period from 1967 until 1991, only two volumes of Dead Sea Scroll material was published. And the people who were supposed to work on them, they did not allow other scholars any access to them. As a result, I mean, that the dissatisfaction grew more and more. I tried to do something about the situation once I arrived in Oxford and persuaded Oxford University Press, the publishers of the scrolls, to put pressure on the editors. They tried, but without any success. And it was in the mid-1980s that the revolution, as it were, began to brew all over the place in the United States, in this country, in the United Kingdom as well. In 1987, we organized here an international conference, inviting all the people who failed to publish their material to come along and explain why and indicate their intentions. They came along, they found excuses, nothing changed. A new editor-in-chief was appointed in the person of John Strugnell, an Englishman teaching at Harvard University. But although he himself had been involved in the work for many years, he didn't actually produce anything significant. And in 1990, he was kind of obliged to resign. And a new editor-in-chief was appointed in the person of the extremely capable Israeli scholar, Emmanuel Tov. But even then, the old policy continued of allowing access only to nominated editors, except that the number of editors was increased from 7 to about 60. I myself got involved at that stage. But then in 1991, along came the revolution, which really blew open the Dead Sea Scrolls to the scholarly world. And since then, any competent scholar has full access to everything.
Geza Vermesh, the late scholar of the Dead Sea Scrolls and early Christianity, joined the School of Oriental Studies at Oxford University, where he shepherded many students, one of whom was Martin Goodman, now professor of Roman and Jewish history at Oxford.
He taught mostly by example. He organized a research seminar, which extraordinarily long lived from 1965 down to the present. Every Tuesday afternoon, he would gather like-minded scholars to come and discuss their research. A great deal of his teaching was by demonstrating how many different ways there were to try to get at the truth, and the need to be critical about all of them. So it's by example, mostly.
Well, you co-authored a book with him on the Essenes. Now, there's a subject that's full of controversy and some wild imaginings. How ready was he to consider some of the more imaginative hypotheses about the Essenes?
Goethe was very open to all ideas, but he had a strong streak of, I suppose, common sense, and he was always inclined to trust his own instinct as to which hypothesis made most sense of the material. In the case of the book that we did together on the Essenes, we came to opposite conclusions as to what they told us about the relationship of the Essenes to the Dead Sea Scrolls. But this didn't worry him. He just thought it important to lay out the evidence so that we could see what it might tell us. Cato's view, which was one that he'd pioneered back in the very beginning of Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship, was that the Essenes wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, and indeed that remains the majority view among most scholars of the scrolls. My own view, once we'd looked at all the conflicting evidence in the Greek and Latin sources about the Essenes, of which there are quite a number, but they say very different things about this Jewish group in the late Second Temple period. My own view was that it became increasingly difficult to combine that evidence with the evidence from the scrolls, and that it's better to see the scrolls as the products of a group about whom we didn't previously know. But I wrote about this specifically in a volume in honor of Geza, and he was very nice about it and said that anything's possible, but he didn't agree.
Well, you're a scholar of Josephus, who wrote a very detailed account of the Essenes in his book, The Jewish War. I don't recall there whether he mentions anything about their library as such. So did you and Geza differ at all in the way you regarded Josephus as a source for the Essenes?
Yes, Josephus wrote about the Essenes in various places, and his a very long description in his account of the Jewish War is the one that has been most often looked at as similar to what you have in the text from Qumran, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And there are all sorts of similarities between this group and what we see in the sectarian Dead Sea Scrolls text. There are also differences, one of which rather striking is that Josephus tells us that the Essenes used to worship every morning the sun to encourage it to rise. It's a very strange thing to say for a Jewish author to say about a Jewish group. And one would then have to explain it, as Geza did, as an error by Josephus, which of course is possible. The question between Geza and me was always where the burden of proof lies, whether one should look for similarities or look for dissimilarities.
Well, Geza published 19 books that I could count, but that probably doesn't include the mammoth task of working with Matthew Black on Emil Schur's A History of the Jewish People in the Time of Jesus Christ, which was a reissue or a really long rewriting or revision of that work. Did you work on that as well?
Yes, I did. I was brought in for the third volume. It was a labor of love. I only had to do a part of volume three, but it was a huge amount of work. And Geyser had been working at it since the 1960s. By the time the whole thing was finally published in the last volume in 1987, I think he was quite pleased it came to an end. But it was a selfless work of dedication to scholarship.
Well, you would have seen him work at close range. How did he produce so much? He must have been astonishingly efficient.
Yeah, he was astonishingly efficient. He also loved it. So there was a sense in which he saw getting down to work in the morning. That's what he did. That was his life. He loved writing. He'd get excited when he had an idea. But I think as much, he loves the process of communicating what he's found. He would polish his prose and get it just right so it could communicate exactly what he had to say. And he did write with exceptional clarity. And this was very important to him. That's what he would do in the morning. First thing after breakfast would be to sit down at his desk and to start writing. And he was still writing and producing new ideas for publication in the week before he died.
Was he actually planning a new book or working on one?
Yes, he was always working on new books. The truth is, I'm not sure what the next book is that's coming out. I know he was working on a new book, the fact that I don't know which one it was is because I wasn't keeping up with him.
Martin Goodman, co-author with Geza Vermeesh of The Essenes According to the Classical Sources. I believe a book by Geza Vermeesh on King Herod is still to come. You're listening to The Spirit of Things. Find us on the RN homepage, where you can download the audio of this program and also read an article by me about Geza, the foremost Dead Sea Scrolls and Jesus scholar. Amy Jill Levine wrote a book called Jesus, the Misunderstood Jew, and I spoke to her when she was in Sydney recently. What influence did Geza Vermeesh have on you, choosing to be a scholar of the New Testament and focusing on Jesus?
When I first started studying the New Testament formally in the academy, most of my professors suggested that perhaps I ought to go into rabbinic literature or study the Dead Sea Scrolls or perhaps Apocrypha or Pseudepigrapha. But they said, Jesus is not quite the right subject for a nice Jewish girl. And my sense was, well, my gosh, if Geza Vermeesh could do this, then maybe there's a possibility for me to follow in his footsteps. So although at the time I had never met him, I had simply read his books, devoured his books, he was like the trailblazer for me. He said, yeah, you can do this. You can do it well. And if you do it well enough, you're sufficiently well-trained and you make a good enough argument, you might be able to change the field. You might be able to get people to listen to you.
Speaking of his books, a look at some of the titles, Jesus the Jew, Jesus and the World of Judaism, The Religion of Jesus the Jew, Jesus in His Jewish Context, a few of many, many books that he wrote on this and other fields. I wonder, was he trying to forge a rapprochement between Judaism and Christianity?
We'd have to ask Professor Vermeesh that, and unfortunately now we can't. So I cannot speak directly to what he was hoping to do. I can talk about what he did. What he did is he opened up, along with some other scholars like Samuel Sanmel, for example, other Jewish scholars, the idea that Jesus could be seen as part of Jewish history. And I was able to take that, and I still do, to my fellow Jews. Look, the first person in literature ever called rabbi is Jesus of Nazareth, just as the only Pharisee from whom we have written records is Paul of Tarsus. If we want to understand our own Jewish history, then Jesus is part of that Jewish history. So just as it's incumbent, I believe, on Christians to understand Jesus within his Jewish context, so I think it is incumbent upon Jews to recognize not only that first century Jewish context, but to recognize Jesus' place within it. Which community, in your estimation, has the greater challenge or the greater difficulty approaching that position?
I think there are challenges on both sides. I've met a number of Jews, particularly on the more Orthodox end, who find it shocking that I even used the word Jesus, who find it appalling that I have dedicated my life to studying him, and a few who deny that he existed in the first place. On the other hand, I've met a number of Christians who, while quite willing to acknowledge that Jesus was Jewish, find it more difficult to look at first century Judaism as having some good points. They want to look at Jesus as unique within his own context. Well, if one is a Christian, Jesus is unique by definition. From Christian claims, his mother was a virgin, he rose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, and he's God. That makes him unique. Therefore, he doesn't have to be unique in terms of all his ethical teachings, in terms of his concern for love of God and love of neighbor. What I want those Christians to realize, and Jews as well, is that when Jesus speaks to his fellow Jews, he's speaking in a Jewish idiom. He's not always saying something new. One does not need to be unique in all cases in order to be profound. Jesus is rather voicing Jewish wisdom.
When I think of the 70s and 80s, and certainly that period in which Geza Vermesh's books had such a great influence on New Testament studies, biblical studies generally, the study of early rabbinic Judaism, I think back of such excitement, of building bridges, as it were, of understanding. What is it like today? Is there as much enthusiasm and passion for building that bridge of understanding as there was in that post-war, post-Holocaust world?
Yeah, I think the construction in terms of those bridge-building activities are even stronger. I'm here in Australia working with principals of Catholic colleges in Melbourne and speaking with Catholic religious educators about Jesus in his Jewish context and the Gospels in their Jewish context. The Jewish Annotated New Testament, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2011, has over 51 Jewish scholars, including Professor Vermesh, contributing information on the Jewish context of the New Testament, information on how Jews have understood Jesus and Paul over time. So what I'm seeing in both the Jewish and the Christian community is a willingness to see those common roots and at the same time recognizing that we have quite distinct branches, so that neither Judaism nor Christianity needs to sacrifice the particulars of its own tradition on the altar of interfaith sensitivity. We can agree on much more now regarding that common history. And because we have that firm historical basis, I think we can better respect where we are today as quite different movements.
Amy Jill Levine commenting there on the legacy of Geza Vermesh's scholarship. She's professor of New Testament studies at Vanderbilt University in the U.S. You're listening to The Spirit of Things, and when I interviewed Geza at his home in Oxford in 1998, I asked him if his own experience of being between Judaism and Christianity gave him the insight and courage of his own convictions about Jesus.
Well, in a way, I'm not drawing connections. I am trying to do the historian's job and determine and enlighten the facts. Now, if these facts lead to a better understanding of the relationship between Judaism and Christianity and to a better social link between Jews and Christians. I applaud this, but I did not set out to promote this. My work, as far as I'm consciously aware, has always been that of someone who was trying to find the truth. And if I had something slightly beyond the objective pursuit, the truth was a consequence of this truth, namely that Jesus was misunderstood both by Jews and Christians. The real Jesus was not the Jesus of Christianity or the bogeyman of Judaism, but something else. And I think this is, I suppose, something very British, which some people laugh at, coming from someone who was born in Hungary. I was trying to put the record straight.
Well, indeed, the record has even been put straight in a dictionary where your definition of Jesus has become authoritative and widely distributed.
Well, that may be so. And I know that this is a new shorter Oxford English dictionary, which defines Jesus no longer as before, as the founder of Christianity, but as a Jewish preacher who was considered by his followers as the Son of God and God incarnate. Well, I dare say I had some part in this, and it created a slight outcry when somebody managed to discover the change in the definition, but I think most people would agree that for an independent dictionary, this is a totally acceptable and probably recommendable definition.
Geza Vermeesh, here we are in your Westwood cottage in Oxford, and it's been a great pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for being on The Spirit of Things.
Well, it was a pleasure.
Well, that wasn't the last time I spoke to Geza Vermeesh, for he published a few more interesting books since then, on the Jesus Nativity stories, for example. I asked his former colleague Martin Goodman in Oxford about Geza's reception among his peers. Well, he's been called the most important Jesus scholar of his generation, but of course there would be those who would disagree. However, some, like the Jews of Jesus, would see his work on Jesus the Jew as kind of vindicating their position. Was he aware of this use of his work?
Yes, I'm sure he was aware, but for him the main thing to do was to get at the truth. And he developed this really quite distinctive awareness coming from his remarkable background that Judaism had developed in all sorts of directions in the late Second Temple period and after. And as a scholar, it was his duty to look at the way in which the Jewish tradition had been reinterpreted in all sorts of different ways from the very start. So his work on Jesus, I think, needs to be seen in the light of the work that he was doing when he first began writing Jesus the Jew, originally on biblical texts, meaning the Hebrew Bible, and the way in which the Bible was always being reinterpreted from the very start. So among his greatest legacies is the whole notion of rewritten Bible. And, of course, his studies of the Dead Sea Scrolls helped him to see this, because that's exactly what he found in the scrolls, the rewriting of biblical texts in the light of current concerns.
Was he at all ostracized because he believed that the continuity between Jesus and Judaism was more profound than the discontinuity or between Jesus and the later church?
Within the field of academic Jewish studies, the answer is no. He was widely respected for taking this aspect of the history of Judaism and as it related to the early church. He was respected for taking it seriously.
Do you have any sense that he was in any way ostracized by Christian scholars?
The answer is, if so, not that seemed to cause him concern. And the title of his autobiography, of course, The Providential Accident, itself tells us that he felt that what had happened in his remarkable life was a good thing. It was all the work of Providence that the right things had happened, which is a wonderful way to view a very complicated life, and certainly the way that he perceived things in the last decades. So there must have been Christian colleagues at the point at which he left the church who were not enthusiastic about what he was doing, but by the time that I knew him from the 1970s, as far as I was aware, it didn't cause him concern.
When I met Geza Vermesh, I was so struck by what a European gentleman he was. He was the very picture of a proper and dignified European gentleman in his three-piece suit and also with a slightly impish humor. Martin, how will you remember Geza Vermesh?
Well, he was an inspiring teacher. He was a bit like a father figure to all his graduate students, not just to me. And now he's not there. The extent to which, even down later on in our careers, the weather was made by Geza. So Geza would decide what it is that we ought to be doing next. And he would just give a hint, and you'd think that's a good idea. So we would all tend to do what Geza suggested we ought to do, usually because he was right. So that sense of care for his students is unusual devotion.
Martin, thank you so much for helping us remember this great scholar and quite distinctive gentleman.
He was, and thank you.
Martin Goodman is professor of Roman and Jewish history at Wolfson College, Oxford. And when he was here recently, I spoke to him about the Roman Jewish historian Josephus. So that interview is coming up on The Spirit of Things later in the year. Meanwhile, the legacy of Jesus, the misunderstood Jew by both Christians and Jews, is something that Amy Jill Levine has spent her academic life unpacking as well. Amy Jill Levine, what were your own personal encounters with Geza Vermesh?
I met him once, 2 years ago. I was on sabbatical at Cambridge, and the folks at Oxford invited me to come over and give a paper. And they said we want it to be partially academic for faculty and students and partially accessible to people from the community who might want to come and hear a paper about Jesus and Judaism. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is wonderful. So the room was packed. It was, in fact, standing room only. And there was this tall, elegant elderly gentleman sitting in the front row who began by frowning at me, and I thought, I need to work on this man. Maybe he's one of those fellows who doesn't quite get the whole Jesus within his Jewish context thing. And I began by talking about the work of Geza Vermesh and what an honor it was for me to be at Oxford, particularly because of him and some of his colleagues, such as Martin Goodman. And then I proceeded to talk about my own work, which I do consider to be an extension of what Professor Vermesh had done. And as I'm talking, I'm noticing that this gentleman is beginning to smile. And at one point, he had a broad grin on his face. And I thought, okay, I'm all right with him. I can now check the rest of the crowd. And the talk went very well. It was very well received with very good questions. At the end, this man sitting in the front row who did not ask a question came over to me and he took me by the hand and he said, Professor Levine, I'm Geza Vermesh. And, you know, I was speechless. And I said, oh, Professor Vermesh. You know, and he said, it was a very good talk. I'm quite delighted with this. And I said, would you mind if I kissed you? And he said, no, not at all. And I kissed him on his cheek and he gave me a hug. I could not have been more delighted. I could not have been more honored. Even thinking about it right now, you know, I can feel my face coloring. I can feel the blush coming up. It was such a marvelous moment. I felt as if he had pronounced me kosher.
Well, if you hadn't met him before then, who were your teachers?
My major teacher was a fellow from Wales named W.D. Davies, who in the United States in the late 70s and early 80s was doing the premier work in terms of locating not only Jesus, but also the Gospels within their Jewish context. And I had read some of Davies' work as an undergraduate. I knew he was teaching in the States, and I had applied to go to Duke University to do a PhD with him. And fortunately, I was accepted. So Davies was my primary teacher. By the time I was ready to write my dissertation, because I had gone directly from undergraduate into a PhD program, Professor Davies had retired, but he remained in the background, in the strong background, providing me the guidance I needed.
Well, he was certainly one of those gods in the pantheon of New Testament studies at that time. Amy Jill, I imagine that you will also be considered one of the goddesses in the pantheon of New Testament studies at some point. Are you passing on this kind of passion for this work? Do you have students coming up who are progressing this field?
I'm trying to do my best, not simply at Vanderbilt, where the New Testament program is in fact quite limited, but in doing as many talks as I can in as many places as I can to get people interested, whether they're undergraduates or secondary school students or contemporary religious educators or just people in the pew, people in the shul, people in civic organizations who might be interested in this. Because part of the whole academic process is not simply from professor to PhD student, it's also to the synagogues and to the churches. It's to people who are working with rabbis, people who are working with priests and ministers, and hoping that a broad message does not remain in the ivory tower, but gets out among the people who actually live the texts. As far as gods and goddesses, I'm Jewish. I've only got one. And I realize very much that I'm standing on the shoulders of greatness.
The Jesus Seminar has had a great influence from the time that Robert Funk began, and of course John Shelby Spong and John Dominic Crossan have been some of the very well-known scholars that are associated with West Star. Where do you sit in relation to their work?
I have a somewhat odd relationship with the Jesus Seminar. Robert Funk, who was the founder of the seminar, used to teach at Vanderbilt University, and I now occupy his office. I'm not a formal member of the Jesus Seminar, but I have actually been invited to give a paper there. After Funk's died, his widow emailed me and said, in honor of Professor Funk, would you come out and do a plenary for us? And I said, well, your Jesus is not really my Jesus, but you know, in Bob Funk's honor, sure, I'd be happy to do that. So I went out to California to do a paper for the Jesus Seminar, and I explained how I thought the Jesus Seminar misconstrued early Judaism. They misconstrued Jewish views of purity. They misconstrued Jewish views of the law. They misconstrued general Jewish views regarding women, and so on. And then I proceeded to explain why by citing sources from the period. At the end of the talk, they looked a tad shocked, and one of the associates said, well, if you're right, we have to reconsider everything that we've done. And I said, that's exactly right. So do I agree with the Jesus Seminar? I agree very much with their idea of bringing biblical studies into the public, because I think they, more than any other group, and this was Funk's genius, said, everybody should be able to read the Bible, and more than that, everybody should be able to ask historical questions of the Bible. It should not simply be in the hands of the religious professionals. But I don't think that they quite understand early Judaism. I don't think they know their way around rabbinic literature as well as perhaps they should. And I think they've too narrowly construed the sources that we can use. For the Jesus Seminar in general, the Gospel of John has no historical credibility whatsoever. But in the Society of Biblical Literature, which is the major professional organization for biblical scholars, the historical background for John is very, very much back on the table. And I think a lot more material in the New Testament has historical credibility than at least some of the early seminar results show. I don't think, for the most part, we can get the exact words of Jesus. He spoke in Aramaic. The New Testament's written in Greek. We don't have any of the original documents, and most of us are reading it in English anyway. But I do think those early sources who were recording Jesus' material had a pretty good sense of, yeah, this sounds like something Jesus would have said, or this seems to be consistent. So I'm not inclined to say, absolutely, he used this word. But I do think from all four Gospels, John, as well as Matthew, Mark, and Luke, hints in Paul, hints in Acts, perhaps hints in some non-canonical texts, we can get a pretty good sense of what Jesus was all about.
Amy Jill, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things.
Always a pleasure to work with you. Thank you.
AJ, as she is known, Amy Jill Levine is professor of New Testament Studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and recently co-edited the Jewish Annotated New Testament. We've been remembering Geza Vermesh, who died aged 88 on May 8th this year. When his complete Dead Sea Scrolls in English were republished after 50 years in 2012, the book sold over 1.5 million copies. Find us on the RN homepage for an article on him and a link to the Spirit of Things website with further information. I'm Rachel Kahn. The Spirit of Things is produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering this week by Russell Stapleton. Talk to you next week at the same time, right back here on RN.
Thousands of people have pinned their hopes on the Royal Commission to stop sex abuse in the churches. But one prominent Catholic bishop says it won't end the crisis in his own church. Jeffrey Robinson is petitioning Pope Francis to convene a major council to rethink celibacy for priests, the culture of obedience, even papal power itself. Thousands of Catholics have signed up, but will Rome listen? Download or stream this Religion and Ethics report from the RN website.